mess room, which led to televisions in the wardroom, and various other crew accommodations. "Skipper, you got a choice. Return of the Jedi or two football tapes. Oklahoma, Nebraska, and Miami, Dallas. Both those games were played while we were on the exercise, sir. It'll be like watching them live," he laughed. "Commercials and all. The cooks are already making the popcorn." "Good. I want everybody nice and loose." Why couldn't they ever get Navy tapes, Mancuso wondered. Of course, Army had creamed them this year. "Morning, Skipper." Wally Chambers, the executive officer, came into the attack center. "What gives?" "Come on back to the wardroom, Wally. I want you to listen to something." Mancuso took the cassette from his shirt pocket and led Chambers aft. The VK Konovalov. 200 miles northeast of the Dallas, in the Norwegian Sea, the Konovalov was racing southwest at 41 knots. Captain Tupolev sat alone in the wardroom, rereading the dispatch he'd received 2 days before. His emotions alternated between rage and grief. The schoolmaster had done that. He was dumbfounded. But what was there to do? Tupolev's orders were explicit, the more so since, as his Sampalit had pointed out, he was a former pupil of the traitor Ramius. He, too, could find himself in a very bad position, if the slug succeeded. So, Marco had pulled a trick on everyone, not just the Konovalov. Tupolev had been slinking around the Barents Sea like a fool while Marco had been heading the other way, laughing at everyone, Tupolev was sure. Such treachery, such a hellish threat against Thorodina. It was inconceivable, and all too conceivable. All the advantages Marco had, a four-room apartment, a Dacha, his own Shiguli. Tupolev did not yet have his own automobile. He had earned his way to a command, and now it was all threatened by this. He'd be lucky to keep what he had. "I have to kill a friend," he thought. "Friend?" "Yes," he admitted to himself. Marco had been a good friend and a fine teacher. Where had he gone wrong? Natalia Bogdanova. Yes, that had to be it. A big stink, the way that had happened. How many times had he had dinner with them? How many times had Natalia laughed about her fine, strong, big sons? He shook his head. A fine woman, killed by a damned incompetent fool of a surgeon. Nothing could be done about it. He was the son of a central committee member. It was an outrage, the way things like that still happened, even after 3 generations of building socialism. But nothing was sufficient to justify this madness. Tupolev bent over the chart he'd brought back. He'd be on his station in 5 days. In less time if the engine plant held together, and Marco wasn't in too much of a hurry. And he wouldn't be. Marco was a fox, not a bull. The other alphas would get there ahead of his, Tupolev knew. But it didn't matter. He had to do this himself. He'd get ahead of Marco and wait. Marco would try to slink past, and the Konovalov would be there. And the Red October would die. The North Atlantic. The British Sea Harrier, FRS-4, appeared a minute early. It hovered briefly off the Kennedy's port beam as the pilot sized up his landing target, the wind, the sea conditions. Maintaining a steady 30-knot forward speed to compensate for the carrier's forward speed, he sideslipped his fighter neatly on the right, then dropped it gently amidships, slightly forward of the Kennedy's island structure, exactly in the center of the flight deck. Instantly, a gang of deck crewmen raced for the aircraft, 3 carrying heavy metal chocks, another a metal ladder, which he set up by the cockpit, whose canopy was already coming open. A team of 4 snaked a fueling hose towards the aircraft, eager to demonstrate the speed with which the U.S. Navy services aircraft. The pilot was dressed in an orange coverall and yellow life jacket. He set his helmet on the back of the front seat and came down the ladder. He watched briefly to be sure his fighter was in capable hands before sprinting to the island. He met Ryan at the hatch. "You Ryan? I'm Tony Parker. Where's the loo?" Jack gave him the proper directions, and the pilot darted off, leaving Ryan standing there in the flight suit, holding his bag and feeling stupid. A white plastic flight helmet dangled from his other hand as they watched the crewmen fueling the Harrier. He wondered if they knew what they were doing. Parker was back in 3 minutes. "Commander," he said, "there's one thing they've never put in a fighter, and that's a bloody toilet. They fill you up with coffee and tea and then they send you off. You've got no place to go. I know the feeling. Anything else you have to do?
No, sir.
Your admiral chatted with me on the radio when I was flying in. Looks like your chaps have finished fueling my bird. Shall we be off?
What do I do with this?
Ryan held up his bag, expecting to have to hold it in his lap. His briefing papers were inside the flight suit, tucked against his chest.
We put it in the boot, of course. Come along, sir.
Parker walked out to the fighter jauntily. The dawn was a feeble one. There was a solid overcast at 1,000 or 2,000 feet. It wasn't raining, but looked as though it might. The sea, still rolling at about 8 feet, was a gray, crinkled surface dotted with whitecaps. Ryan could feel the Kennedy moving, surprised that something so huge could be made to move at all. When they got to the Harrier, Parker took the duffel in one hand and reached for a recessed handle on the underside of the fighter. Twisting and pulling the lever, he revealed a cramped space about the size of a small refrigerator. Parker stuffed the bag into it, slamming the door shut behind it, making sure the locking lever was fully engaged. A deck crewman in a yellow shirt conferred with the pilot. Aft, a helicopter was revving its engines, and a Tomcat fighter was taxiing towards a midships catapult. On top of this, a 30-knot wind was blowing. The carrier was a noisy place. Parker waved Ryan up the ladder. Jack, who liked ladders about as much as he liked flying, nearly fell into his seat. He struggled to get situated properly while a deck crewman strapped him into the 4-point restraint system. The man put the helmet on Ryan's head and pointed to the jack for its intercom system. Maybe American crews really did know something about Harriers. Next to the plug was the switch. Ryan flipped it.
Can you hear me, Parker?
Yes, Commander. All settled in?
I suppose.
Right.
Parker's head swiveled to check the engine intakes.
Starting the engine.
The canopy stayed up. 3 crewmen stood close by with large carbon dioxide extinguishers, presumably in case the engine exploded. 12 others were standing by the island, watching the strange aircraft as the Pegasus engine screamed to life. Then the canopy came down.
Ready, Commander?
If you are.
The Harrier was not a large fighter, but it was certainly the loudest. Ryan could feel the engine noise ripple through his body as Parker adjusted his thrust vector controls. The aircraft wobbled, dipped at the nose, then rose shakily into the air. Ryan saw a man by the island, point and gesture to them. The Harrier slid to port, moving away from the island as it gained in height.
Well, that wasn't too bad, Parker said.
He adjusted the thrust controls, and the Harrier began true forward flight. There was little feeling of acceleration, but Ryan saw that the Kennedy was rapidly falling behind. A few seconds later, they were beyond the inner ring of escorts.
Let's get on top of this muck, Parker said.
He pulled back on the stick and headed for the clouds. In seconds they were in them, and Ryan's field of view was reduced from 5 miles to 5 feet in an instant. Jack looked around his cockpit, which had flight controls and instruments. Their airspeed showed 150 knots and rising, altitude 400 feet. This Harrier had evidently been a trainer, but the instrument panel had been altered to include the readout instruments for a sensor pod that could be attached to the belly. A poor man's way of doing things, but from what Admiral Painter said, it had evidently worked well enough. He figured the TV-type screen was the FLIR readout, which monitored a forward-looking infrared heat sensor. The airspeed gauge now said 300 knots, and the climb indicator showed a 20-degree angle of attack. It felt like more than that.
Should be hitting the top of this soon, Parker said.
Now!
The altimeter showed 26,000 feet when Ryan was blasted by pure sunlight. One thing about flying that he never got used to was that no matter how awful the weather was on the ground, if you flew high enough, you could always find the sun. The light was intense, but the sky's color was noticeably deeper than the soft blue seen from the ground. The ride became airliner smooth as they escaped the lower turbulence. Ryan fumbled with his visor to shield his eyes.
That better, sir?
Fine, Lieutenant. It's better than I expected.
What do you mean, sir?
Parker inquired.
I guess it beats flying on a commercial bird. You can see more. That helps.
Sorry, we don't have any extra fuel, or I'd show you some aerobatics. The Harrier will do almost anything you ask of her.
That's all right.
And your admiral, Parker went on conversationally, said that you don't fancy flying.
Ryan's hands grabbed the armrest as the carrier went through three complete revolutions before snapping back to level flight. He surprised himself by laughing.
Ha, the British sense of humor.
Orders from your admiral, sir, Parker semi-apologized. We wouldn't want you to think the Harry is another bloody boss.
Which admiral, Ryan wondered, Painter or Davenport? Probably both. The top of the clouds was like a rolling field of cotton. He'd never appreciated that before. Looking through a foot-square window on an airliner, in the back seat, he almost felt as if he were sitting outside.
May I ask a question, sir?
Sure.
What's the flap?
What do you mean?
I mean, sir, that they turn my ship around, and then I get orders to ferry a VIP from Kennedy to Invincible.
Oh, okay. Can't say, Parker. I'm delivering some messages to your boss. I'm just the mailman. Ryan lied. Roll that one three times.
Excuse me, Commander, but you see, my wife is expecting a child, our first, soon after Christmas. I hope to be there, sir.
Where do you live?
Chatham.
I know. I live in England myself at the moment. Our place is in Marlow, upriver from London. My second kid got started over there.
Born there?
Started there. My wife says it's those strange hotel beds. Do it to her every time. If I were a betting man, I'd give you good odds, Parker. First babies are always late anyway.
You say you live in Marlow?
That's right. We built a house there earlier this year.
Jack Ryan. John Ryan. The same chap who...
Correct. You don't have to tell anybody that, Lieutenant.
Understood, sir. I didn't know you were a naval officer.
That's why you don't have to tell anyone.
Yes, sir. Sorry for the stunt earlier.
That's all right. Admirals must have their little laughs. I understand. You guys just ran an exercise with our guys.
Indeed we did. Commander, I sank one of your submarines. The Tullaby. My systems operator and I, that is. We caught her near the surface at night with our FLIR and dropped noisemakers all around her. You see, we didn't let anyone know about our new equipment. All's fair, as you know. I understand her commander was bloody furious. I'd hoped to meet him in Norfolk, but he didn't arrive until the day we sailed.
You guys have a good time in Norfolk?
Oh, yes, Commander. We were able to get in a day's shooting at your Chesapeake Bay, the Eastern Shore, I believe you call it.
Oh, yeah. I used to hunt there. How was it?
Not bad. I got my 3 geese in half an hour.
Bag limit was 3.
Stupid. You called in and blasted 3 geese in half an hour this late in the season?
That is how I earn my modest living.
Commander, shooting, Parker commented.
I was up for a grouse shoot with your admiral last September. They made me use a double. If you show up with my kind of gun, I use a Remington automatic. They look at you like you're some kind of terrorist. I got stuck with a pair of Purdy's that didn't fit. Got 15 birds. Seemed an awful lazy way to hunt, though, with one guy loading my gun for me and another platoon of ghillies driving the game. We just about annihilated the bird population, too.
We have more game per acre than you do.
That's what the admiral said.
How far to Invincible?
40 minutes.
Ryan looked at the fuel gauges. They were half empty already. In a car, he'd be thinking about a fill-up. All that fuel gone in half an hour.
Well, Parker didn't seem excited.
The landing on HMS Invincible was different from the COD's arrival on the Kennedy. The ride became rocky as Parker descended through the clouds, and it occurred to Ryan that they were on the leading edge of the same storm he'd endured the night before. The canopy was coated with rain, and he'd heard the impact of thousands of raindrops on the airframe. Or was it hail? Watching the instruments, he saw that Parker leveled out at 1,000 feet while they were still in the clouds, then descended more slowly, breaking into the clear at 100 feet. The Invincible was scarcely half the Kennedy's size. He watched her bobbing actively on the 15-foot seas. Parker used the same technique as before. He hovered briefly on the carrier's port side, then slid to the right, dropping the fighter 20 feet onto a painted circle. The landing was hard, but Ryan was able to see it coming. The canopy came up at once.
"You can get out here," Parker said. "I have to taxi to the elevator."
A ladder was already in place. He unbuckled and got out. A crewman had already retrieved his bag. Ryan followed him to the island and was met by an ensign, a sub-lieutenant, the British call the rank.
"Welcome aboard, sir."
The youngster couldn't be more than 20, Ryan thought.
"Let me help you out of your flight suit."
The sub-lieutenant stood by as Ryan unzipped and took off his helmet, Mae West and coverall. He retrieved his cap from the bag. In the process, he bounced off the bulkhead a few times. The Invincible seemed to be corkscrewing in a following sea. A bow wind in a following sea? In the North Atlantic in winter? Nothing was too crazy. The officer took his bag, and Ryan held onto the briefing material. "Lead on, Lieutenant," Ryan gestured. The youngster shot up a series of three ladders, leaving Jack panting behind, thinking about the jogging he wasn't getting in. The combination of the ship's motion and an inner ear badly scrambled from the day's flying made him dizzy, and he found himself bumping into things. How did professional pilots do it?
"Here's the flag bridge, sir." The sub-lieutenant held the door open.
"Hello, Jack," boomed the voice of Vice Admiral John White, 8th Earl of Weston. He was a tall, well-built man of 50, with a florid complexion set off by a white scarf at his neck. Jack had first met him earlier in the year, and since then his wife Kathy and the Countess Antonia had become close friends, members of the same circle of amateur musicians. Kathy Ryan played classical piano. Tony White, an attractive woman of 44, owned a Guarnieri del Gesù violin. Her husband was a man whose peerage was treated as a convenient afterthought. His career in the Royal Navy had been built entirely on merit. Jack walked over to take his hand.
"Good day, Admiral. How was your flight?"
"Different. I've never been in a fighter before, much less one with ambitions to mate with a hummingbird." Ryan smiled. The bridge was overheated, and it felt good.
"Jolly good. Let's go aft to my sea cabin."
White dismissed the sub-lieutenant, who handed Jack his bag before withdrawing. The admiral led him aft through a short passageway and left into a small compartment. It was surprisingly austere, considering that the English liked their comforts and that White was a peer. There were two curtained portholes, a desk, and a couple of chairs. The only human touch was a color photograph of his wife. The entire port wall was covered with a chart of the North Atlantic.
"You look tired, Jack."
White waved him to the upholstered chair.
"I am tired. I've been on the go since 6 a.m. yesterday. I don't know about the time changes. I think my watch is still on European time."
"I have a message for you." White pulled a slip of paper from his pocket and handed it over. "Greer to Ryan. Willow confirmed," Ryan read. "Basil sends regards. Ends." Somebody had confirmed Willow. Who? Maybe Sir Basil? Maybe Ritter? Ryan would not quote odds on that one. Jack tucked it in his pocket.
"This is good news, sir."
"Why the uniform?"
"Not my idea, Admiral. You know who I work for, right? They figured I'd be less conspicuous this way."
"At least it fits." The Admiral lifted a phone and ordered refreshments sent to them.
"How's the family, Jack?"
"Fine, thank you, sir. The day before I came over, Kathy and Tony were playing over at Nigel Ford's place. I missed it. You know, if they get much better, we ought to have a record cut. There aren't too many violin players better than your wife."
A steward arrived with a plate full of sandwiches. Jack had never figured out the British taste for cucumbers on bread.
"So, what's the flap?"
"Admiral, the significance of the message you just gave me is that I can tell this to you and three other officers. This is very hot stuff, sir. You'll want to make your choices accordingly."
"Hot enough to turn my little fleet around," White thought it over, before lifting the phone and ordering three of his officers to the cabin. He hung up.
"Captain Carstairs, Captain Hunter, Commander Barclay. They are, respectively, Invincible's commanding officer, my fleet operations officer, and my fleet intelligence officer."
"No chief of staff?"
"Flew home. Death in the family. Something for your coffee?"
White extracted what looked like a brandy bottle from his desk drawer.
"Thank you, Admiral."
He was grateful for the brandy. The coffee needed the help. He watched the Admiral pour a generous amount, perhaps with the ulterior motive of making him speak more freely. White had been a British sailor longer than he'd been Ryan's friend. The three officers arrived together, two carrying folding chairs.
"Admiral," Ryan began, "you might want to leave that bottle out. After you hear this story, we might all need a drink."
He passed out his two remaining briefing folders and talked from memory. His delivery took 15 minutes.
"Gentlemen," he concluded, "I must insist that this information be kept strictly confidential. For the moment, no one outside this room may learn it."
"That is too bad," Carstairs said. "This makes for a bloody good sea story."
"And our mission?" White was holding the photographs.
He poured Ryan another shot of brandy, gave the bottle a brief look, then stowed it back in the desk. Thank you, Admiral. For the moment, our mission is to locate Red October. After that, we're not sure. I imagine just locating her will be hard enough.
An astute observation, Commander Ryan, Hunter said.
The good news is that Admiral Painter has requested that Sinklant assign you control of several U.S. Navy vessels, probably 3 1052-class frigates and a pair of FFG-7 Perrys. They all carry a chopper or two.
Well, Jeffrey? White asked.
It's a start, Hunter agreed. They'll be arriving in a day or two. Admiral Painter asked me to express his confidence in your group and its personnel.
A whole fucking Russian missile submarine, Barclay said almost to himself.
Ryan laughed. Like the idea, Commander. At least he had one convert.
What if the sub is heading for the UK? Does it then become a British operation? Barclay asked pointedly.
I suppose it would, but from the way I read the map, if Romius was heading for England, he'd already be there. I saw a copy of the President's letter to the Prime Minister. In return for your assistance, the Royal Navy gets the same access to the data we develop as our guys get. We're on the same side, gentlemen. The question is, can we do it?
Hunter? The Admiral asked. If this intelligence is correct, I'd say we have a good chance. Perhaps as good as 50%. On one hand, we have a missile submarine attempting to evade detection. On the other, we have a great deal of ASW arrayed to locate her, and she will be heading toward one of only a few discrete locations. Norfolk, of course. Newport, Groton, Kings Bay, Port Everglades, Charleston. A civilian port such as New York is less likely, I think. The problem is, what with Ivan sending all his alphas racing to your coast, they will get there ahead of October. They may have a specific port target in mind. We'll know that in another day. So I'd say they have an equal chance. They'll be able to operate far enough from your coast that your government will have no viable legal reason to object to whatever they do. If anything, I'd say the Soviets have the advantage. They have both a clearer idea of the submarine's capabilities and a simpler overall mission. That more than balances their less capable sensors.
Why isn't Romius coming on faster? Ryan asked. That's the one thing I can't figure. Once he clears the Sosis lines off Iceland, he's clear into the deep basin, so why not crack his throttles wide open and race for our coast?
At least two reasons, Barclay answered. How much operational intelligence data do you see?
I handle individual assignments. That means I hop around a lot from one thing to another. I know a good deal about their boomers, for example, but not as much about their attack boats. Ryan didn't have to explain, he was CIA.
Well, you know how compartmentalized the Sovs are. Romius probably doesn't know where their attack submarines are, not all of them. So if he were to race about, he'd run the off chance of blundering into a stray victor and being sunk without ever knowing what was happening. Second, what if the Soviets did enlist American assistance, saying perhaps that a missile sub had been taken over by a mutinous crew of Maoist counter-revolutionaries, and then your Navy detects a missile submarine racing down the North Atlantic towards the American coast? What would your president do?
Yeah. Ryan nodded. We blow it the hell out of the water.
There you have it. Romius is in the trade of stealth, and he'll likely stick to what he knows, Barclay concluded. Fortunately or unfortunately, he's jolly good at it.
How soon will we have performance data on this quiet drive system? Carstairs wanted to know.
Next couple of days, we hope.
Where does Admiral Painter want us? White asked.
The plan he submitted to Norfolk puts you on the right flank. He wants Kennedy inshore to handle the threat from their surface force. He wants your force farther out. You see, Painter thinks there's a chance that Romius will come straight south from the GIUK gap into the Atlantic Basin and just sit for a while. The odds favor his not being detected there, and if the Soviets send the fleet after him, he's got the time and supplies to sit out there longer than they can maintain a force off our coast, both for technical and political reasons. Additionally, he wants your striking power out there to threaten their flank. It has to be approved by the Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic Fleet, and a lot of details remain to be worked out. For example, Painter requested some E-3 sentries to support you out here.
A month in the middle of the North Atlantic in winter, Carstairs winced. He'd been the Invincible's executive officer during the war around the Falklands and had written in the Violet South Atlantic for endless weeks.
Be happy for the E-3s, the Admiral smiled. Hunter, I want to see plans for using all these ships the Yanks are giving us, and how we can cover a maximum area. Barclay, I want to see your evaluation of what our friend Rummius will do. Assume he's still the clever bastard we've come to know and love.
Aye, aye, sir. Barclay stood with the others.
Jack, how long will you be with us?
I don't know, Admiral. Until they recall me to the Kennedy, I guess. From where I sit, this operation was laid on too fast. Nobody really knows what the hell we're supposed to do.
Well, why don't you let us see to this for a while? You look exhausted. Get some sleep.
True enough, Admiral. Ryan was beginning to feel the brandy.
There's a cot in the locker over there. I'll have someone set it up for you. And you can sleep in here for the time being. If anything comes in for you, we'll get you up.
That's kind of you, sir. Admiral White was a good guy, Jack thought, and his wife was something very special. In 10 minutes, Ryan was on the cot and asleep. The Red October. Every 2 days, the Star Palm collected the radiation badges. This was part of a semi-formal inspection. After seeing to it that every crewman's shoes were spit-shined, every bunk was properly made, and every footlocker was arranged according to the book, the executive officer would take the 2-day-old badges and hand the sailors new ones, usually along with some terse advice to square themselves away as new Soviet men ought. Borodin had this procedure down to a science. Today, as always, the trip from one compartment to another took 2 hours. When he was finished, the bag on his left hip was full of old badges, and the one on his right was depleted of new ones. He took the badges to the ship's medical office.
Comrade Petrov, I have a gift for you.
Borodin set the leather bag on the physician's desk.
Good.
The doctor smiled up at the executive officer.
With all the healthy young men, I have little to do but read my journals.
Borodin left Petrov to his task. First, the doctor set the badges out in order. Each bore a 3-digit number. The first digit identified the badge series, so that if any radiation were detected, there would be a time reference. The second digit showed where the sailor worked. The third, where he slept. The system was easier to work with than the old one, which had used individual numbers for each man. The developing process was cookbook simple. Petrov could do it without a thought. First, he switched off the white overhead light and replaced it with a red one. Then he locked his office door. Next, he took the development rack from its holder on the bulkhead, broke open the plastic holders, and transferred the film strips to spring clips on the rack. Petrov took the rack into the adjacent laboratory and hung it on the handle of the single filing cabinet. He filled 3 large square basins with chemicals. Though a qualified physician, he had forgotten most of his inorganic chemistry and didn't remember exactly what the developing chemicals were. Basin number 1 was filled from bottle number 1. Basin 2 was filled from bottle 2. And basin 3, he remembered, was filled with water. Petrov was in no hurry. The midday meal was not for 2 more hours, and his duties were truly boring. The last 2 days he had been reading his medical texts on tropical diseases. The doctor was looking forward to visiting Cuba as much as anyone aboard. With luck, a crewman would come down with some obscure malady, and he'd have something interesting to work on for once. Petrov set the lab timer for 75 seconds and submerged the film strips in the first basin as he pressed the start button. He watched the timer under the red light, wondering if the Cubans still made rum. He had been there, too, years before, and acquired a taste for the exotic liquor. Like any good Soviet citizen, he loved his vodka, but had the occasional hankering for something different. The timer went off, and he lifted the rack, shaking it carefully over the tank. No sense getting the chemical, silver nitrate, something like that, on his uniform. The rack went into the second tank, and he set the timer again. Pity the orders had been so damn secret. He could have brought his tropical uniform. He'd sweat like a pig in the Cuban heat. Of course, none of those savages ever bothered to wash. Maybe they had learned something in the past 15 years. He'd see. The timer dinged again, and Petrov lifted the rack a second time, shaking it and setting it into the water-filled basin. Another boring job completed. Why couldn't a sailor fall down a ladder and break something? He wanted to use his East German X-ray machine on a live patient. He didn't trust the Germans, Marxists or not, but they did make good medical equipment, including his X-ray, autoclave, and most of his pharmaceuticals. Time. Petrov lifted the rack and held it up against the X-ray reading plate, which he switched on.
Ничего!
Petrov breathed. He had to think. His badge was fogged. Its number was 348. Third badge series, frame 54. The medical office galley section. Aft, officers, accommodation. Though only 2 centimeters across, the badges were made with variable sensitivity. 10 vertically segmented columns were used to quantify the exposure level. Petrov saw that his was fogged all the way to segment 4. The engine room crewmen's were fogged to segment 5, and the torpedo men, who spent all their time forward, showed contamination only in segment 1.
Son of a bitch!
He knew the sensitivity levels by heart. He took the manual down to check them anyway. Fortunately, the segments were logarithmic. His exposure was 12 rads, 15 to 25 for the engineers, 12 to 25 in 2 days. Not enough to be dangerous. Not really life-threatening, but... Petrov went back into his office, careful to leave the films in the lab. He picked up the phone.
Captain Ramius, Petrov here. Could you come aft to my office, please?
On the way, comrade doctor.
Ramius took his time. He knew what the call was about. The day before they sailed, while Petrov had been ashore, procuring drugs for his cupboard, Borodin had contaminated the badges with the X-ray machine.
Yes, Petrov.
Ramius closed the door behind him.
Comrade Captain, we have a radiation leak.
Nonsense. Our instruments would have detected it at once.
Petrov got the films from the lab and handed them to the captain.
Look here.
Ramius held them up to the light, scanning the film strips top to bottom. He frowned.
Who knows of this?
You and I, Comrade Captain.
You will tell no one.
No one.
Ramius paused.
Any chance that the films were... that they have something wrong, that you made an error in the developing process?
Petrov shook his head emphatically.
No, Comrade Captain. Only you, Comrade Borodin, and I have access to these. As you know, I tested random samples from each batch 3 days before we sailed.
Petrov wouldn't admit that, like everyone, he had taken the samples from the top of the box they were stored in. They weren't really random.
The maximum exposure I see here is 10 to 20?
Ramius understated it.
Whose numbers?
Bulganin and Surtsboy. The torpedo men forward are all under 3 rads.
Very well. What we have here, Comrade Doctor, is a possible minor, Petrov, leak in the reactor spaces. At worst, a gas leak of some sort. This has happened before, and no one has ever died from it. The leak will be found and fixed. We will keep this little secret. There is no reason to get the men excited over nothing.
Petrov nodded agreement, knowing that men had died in 1970 in an accident on the submarine Voroshilov, more in the icebreaker Lenin. Both accidents were a long time ago, though, and he was sure Ramius could handle things. Wasn't he? The Pentagon. The E-ring was the outermost and largest of the Pentagon's rings, and since its outside windows offered something other than a view of sunless courtyards, this was where the most senior defense officials had their offices. One of these was the office of the Director of Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the J-3. He wasn't there. He was down in a sub-basement room known colloquially as the tank because its metal walls were dotted with electronic noisemakers to foil other electronic devices. He had been there for 24 hours. Though one would not have known this from his appearance. His green trousers were still creased. His khaki shirt still showed the folds made by the laundry, its collars starched plywood stiff, and his tie was held neatly in place by a gold Marine Corps tie pin. Lieutenant General Edwin Harris was neither a diplomat nor a service academy graduate, but he was playing peacemaker, an odd position for a Marine.
God damn it!
It was the voice of Admiral Blackburn, Sinclair. Also present was his own operations officer, Rear Admiral Pete Stanford.
Is this any way to run an operation?
The Joint Chiefs were all there, and none of them thought so.
Look, Blackie, I told you where the orders come from.
General Hilton, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sounded tired.
I understand that, General, but this is largely a submarine operation, right? I gotta get Vince Gallery in on this, and you should have Sam Dodge working up at this end. Dan and I are both fighter jocks. Pete's an ASW expert. We need a sub-driver in on this.
Gentlemen, Harris said calmly, for the moment the plan we have to take to the President need only deal with the Soviet threat.
Let's hold this story about the defecting boomer in abeyance for the moment, shall we?
I agree, Stanford nodded. We have enough to worry about right here.
The attention of the 8 flag officers turned to the map table. 58 Soviet submarines and 28 surface warships, plus a gaggle of oiler and replenishment ships, were unmistakably heading for the American coast. To face this, the U.S. Navy had one available carrier. The Invincible did not rate as such. The threat was considerable. Among them, the Soviet vessels carried over 300 surface-to-surface cruise missiles. Though principally designed as anti-ship weapons, the third of them believed to carry nuclear warheads were sufficient to devastate the cities on the East Coast. From a position off New Jersey, these missiles could range from Norfolk to Boston.
Josh Painter proposes that we keep Kennedy inshore, Admiral Blackburn said. He wants to run the ASW operations from his carrier, transferring his light attack squadrons to shore and replacing them with S-3s. He wants Invincible out on their seaward flank.
I don't like it, General Harris said. Neither did Pete Stanford, and they had agreed earlier that the J-3 would launch the counterplan. Gentlemen, if we're only going to have one deck to use, we damn well ought to have a carrier and not an oversized ASW platform.
We're listening, Eddie, Hilton said.
Let's move Kennedy out there. He moved the counter to a position west of the Azores. Josh keeps his attack squadrons. We move Invincible inshore to handle the ASW work. It's what the Brits designed her for, right? They're supposed to be good at it. Kennedy is an offensive weapon. Her mission is to threaten them. Okay, if we deploy like this, she is the threat. From over here, she can range against their surface force from outside their surface-to-surface missile perimeter. Better yet, Stanford interjected, pointing to some vessels on the map. Threaten this surface force over here. If they lose these oilers, they ain't going home. To meet that threat, they'll have to redeploy themselves. For starters, they'll have to move Kiev offshore to give themselves some kind of air defense against Kennedy. We can use the spare S-3s from shore bases. They can still patrol the same area. He traced a line about 500 miles off the coast.
Leaves Invincible kind of naked, though, the CNO, Admiral Foster, noted.
Josh was asking about some E-3 coverage for the Brits. Blackburn looked at the Air Force Chief of Staff, General Claire Barnes.
You want help? You get help, Barnes said. We'll have a sentry operating over Invincible at dawn tomorrow, and if you move her inshore, we can maintain that round the clock. I'll throw in a wing of F-16s if you want.
What do you want in return, Max? Foster asked.
Nobody called him Claire.
The way I see this, you have Saratoga's air wing sitting around doing nothing. Okay, by Saturday, I'll have 500 tactical fighters deployed from Dover to Loring. My boys don't know much about anti-ship stuff. They'll have to learn in a hurry. I want you to send your kids to work with mine, and I also want your Tomcats. I like the fighter-missile combination. Let one squadron work out of Iceland, the other out of New England, to track the bears Ivan's starting to send our way. I'll sweeten that. If you want, we'll send some tankers to Lajes to help keep Kennedy's birds flying.
Blackie? Foster asked.
Deal, Blackburn nodded. The only thing that bothers me is that Invincible doesn't have all that much ASW capacity.
So we get more, Stanford said.
Admiral, what say we take Tarawa out of Little Creek, team her with New Jersey's group, with a dozen ASW choppers aboard and 7 or 8 Harriers?
I like it, Harris said quickly.
Then we have 2 baby carriers with a noteworthy striking force right in front of their groups, Kennedy playing stalking tiger to their east and a few hundred tactical fighters to the west. They have to come into a 3-way box. This actually gives us more ASW patrolling capacity than we'd have otherwise.
Can Kennedy handle her mission alone out there? Hilton asked.
Depend on it, Blackburn replied. We can kill any one, maybe any 2 of these 4 groups in an hour. The ones near ashore will be your job, Max.
How long did you 2 characters rehearse this, General Maxwell, Commandant of the Marine Corps? Asked the operations officers.
Everyone chuckled.
The Red October. Chief Engineer Melekin cleared the reactor compartment before beginning the check for the leak. Ramius and Petrov were there also, plus the engineering duty officers and one of the young lieutenants, Sviadov. 3 of the officers carried Geiger counters. The reactor room was quite large. It had to be to accommodate the massive, barrel-shaped steel vessel. The object was warm to the touch, despite being inactive. Automatic radiation detectors were in every corner of the room, each surrounded by a red circle. More were hanging on the fore and aft bulkheads. Of all the compartments on the submarine, this was the cleanest. The deck and bulkheads were spotless white-painted steel. The reason was obvious. The smallest leak of reactor coolant had to be instantly visible, even if all the detectors failed. Sviadov climbed an aluminium ladder affixed to the side of the reactor vessel to run the detachable probe from his counter over every welded pipe joint. The speaker annunciator on the handheld box was turned to maximum so that everyone in the compartment could hear it. And Sviadov had an earpiece plugged in for even greater sensitivity. A youngster of 21, he was nervous. Only a fool would feel entirely safe looking for a radiation leak. There's a joke in the Soviet Navy. How do you tell a sailor from the Northern Fleet? He glows in the dark. It had been a good laugh on the beach, but not now. He knew that he was conducting the search because he was the youngest, least experienced, and most expendable officer. It was an effort to keep his knees from wobbling as he strained to reach all over and around the reactor piping. The counter was not entirely silent, and Sviadov's stomach cringed at each click generated by the passage of a random particle through the tube of ionized gas. Every few seconds, his eyes flickered to the dial that measured intensity. It was well inside the safe range, hardly registering at all. The reactor vessel was a quadruple-layer design, each layer several centimeters of tough stainless steel. The three inner spaces were filled with a barium water mixture, then a barrier of lead, then polyethylene, all designed to prevent the escape of neutrons and gamma particles. The combination of steel, barium, lead, and plastic successfully contained the dangerous elements of the reaction, allowing only a few degrees of heat to escape, and the dial showed much to his relief that the radiation level was less than that on the beach at Sochi. The highest reading was made next to a light bulb. This made the lieutenant smile.
All readings in normal range, comrades, Sviadov replied.
Start over, Melikhin ordered, from the beginning.
20 minutes later, Sviadov, now sweating from the warm air that gathered at the top of the compartment, made an identical report. He came down awkwardly, his arms and legs tired.
Have a cigarette, Ramya suggested. You did well, Sviadov.
Thank you, comrade captain. It's warm up there from the lights and the coolant pipes.
The lieutenant handed the counter to Melikhin. The lower dial showed a cumulative count, well within the safe range.
Probably some contaminated badges, the chief engineer commented sourly. It would not be the first time.
Some joker in the factory, or at the yard supply office. Something for our friends in the GRU to check into. Wreckers! A joke like this ought to earn somebody a bullet.
Perhaps, Ramius chuckled. Remember the incident on Lenin?
He referred to the nuclear-powered icebreaker that had spent 2 years tied to the dock, unusable because of a reactor mishap.
A ship's cook had some badly crusted pans, and a madman of an engineer suggested that he use live steam to get them cleaned. So the idiot walked down to the steam generator and opened an inspection valve with his pots under it.
Melikhin rolled his eyes.
I remember it. I was a staff engineering officer then.
The captain had asked for a Kazakh cook.
He liked horse meat with his kasha, Ramius said.
And the fool didn't know the first thing about a ship. Killed himself and 3 other men. Contaminated the whole fucking compartment for 20 months. The captain only got out of the gulag last year.
I bet the cook got his pans clean, though, Ramius observed.
Indeed, Mako Alexandrovich. They may even be safe to use. In another 50 years,
Melikhin laughed raucously. That was a hell of a thing to say in front of a young officer, Petrov thought. There was nothing, nothing at all funny about a reactor leak. But Melikhin was known for his heavy sense of humor, and the doctor imagined that 20 years of working on reactors allowed him and the captain to view the potential dangers phlegmatically. Then, there was the implicit lesson in the story. Never let someone who does not belong into the reactor spaces.
Very well, Melikhin said.
Now we check the pipes in the generator room. Come, Sviadov, we still need your young legs.
The next compartment aft contained the heat exchanger, steam generator, turbo alternators, and auxiliary equipment. The main turbines were in the next compartment, now inactive, while the electrically driven Caterpillar was operating. In any case, the steam that turned them was supposed to be clean. The only radioactivity was in the inside loop. The reactor coolant, which carried short-lived but dangerous radioactivity, never flashed to steam. This was in the outside loop and boiled from uncontaminated water. The two water supplies met, but never mixed inside the heat exchanger, the most likely site for a coolant leak because of its more numerous fittings and valves. The more complex piping required a full 50 minutes to check. These pipes were not as well insulated as those forward. Sviadov nearly burned himself twice, and his face was bathed in perspiration by the time he finished the first sweep.
"Readings all safe again, comrades."
"Good," Melikhin said. "Come down and rest a moment before you check it again."
Sviadov almost thanked his chief for that, but this would not have done at all. As a young, dedicated officer and member of the Komsomol, no exertion was too great. He came down carefully, and Melikhin handed him another cigarette. The chief engineer was a gray-haired perfectionist who took decent care of his men.
"Why, thank you, comrade," Sviadov said.
Petrov got a folding chair.
"Sit, comrade lieutenant. Rest your legs."
The lieutenant sat down at once, stretching his legs to work out the knots. The officers at VVMUPP had told him how lucky he was to draw this assignment. Romius and Melikhin were the two best teachers in the fleet, men whose crews appreciated their kindness, along with their competence.
"They really should insulate those pipes," Romius said.
Melikhin shook his head.
"Then they'd be too hard to inspect."
He handed the counter to his captain.
"Entirely safe."
The captain read off the cumulative dial.
"You get more exposure tending a garden."
"Indeed," Melikhin said. "Coal miners get more exposure than we do from the release of radon gas in the mines. Bad badges, that's what it has to be. Why not take out a whole batch and check it?"
"I could, comrade," Petrov answered. "But then, due to the extended nature of our cruise, we'd have to run for several days without any. Contrary to regulations, I'm afraid."
"You are correct. In any case, the badges are only a backup to our instruments."
Romius gestured to the red circle detectors all over the compartment.
"Do you really want to recheck the piping?" Melikhin asked.
"I think we should," Romius said.
Sviadov swore to himself, looking down at the deck.
"There is no extravagance in the pursuit of safety," Petrov quoted doctrine.
"Sorry, lieutenant." The doctor was not a bit sorry. He had been genuinely worried and was now feeling a lot better. An hour later, the second check had been completed. Petrov took Sviadov forward for salt tablets and tea to rehydrate himself. The senior officer left, and Melikhin ordered the reactor plant restarted. The enlisted men filed back to their duty stations, looking at one another. Their officers had just checked the hot compartments with radiation instruments. The medical orderly had looked pale a while earlier and refused to say anything. More than one engine attendant fingered his radiation badge and checked his wristwatch to see how long it would be before he went off duty. The 8th day, Friday, 10th December. HMS Invincible. Ryan awoke in the dark. The curtains were drawn on the cabin's two small portholes. He shook his head a few times to clear it and began to assess what was going on around him. The Invincible was moving on the seas, but not as much as before. He got up to look out of a porthole and saw the last red glow of sunset aft under scudding clouds. He checked his watch and did some clumsy mental arithmetic, concluding that it was 6 in the evening, local time. That translated to about 6 hours of sleep. He felt pretty good, considering. A minor headache from the brandy, so much for the theory that good stuff doesn't give you a hangover, and his muscles were stiff. He did a few sit-ups to work out the knots. There was a small bathroom, head, he corrected himself, adjoining the cabin. Ryan splashed some water on his face and washed his mouth out, not wanting to look in the mirror. He decided he had to. Counterfeit or not,
He was wearing his country's uniform, and he had to look presentable. It took a minute to get his hair in place and the uniform arranged properly. The CAA had done a nice job of tailoring, given such short notice. Finished, he went out of the door towards the flag bridge.
"Feeling better, Jack?"
Admiral White pointed him to a tray full of cups. It was only tea, but it was a start.
"Thank you, Admiral. Those few hours really helped. I guess I'm in time for dinner."
"Breakfast," White corrected him with a laugh.
"What? Pardon me, Admiral?"
Ryan shook his head again. He was still a little groggy.
"That's a sunrise, Commander.
Change in orders. We're heading west again. Kennedy's moving east at high speed, and we're to take station inshore."
"Who said, sir?"
"Sinclair. I gather Joshua was not at all pleased. You are to remain with us for the moment, and under the circumstances it seems the reasonable thing to let you sleep. You did appear to need it."
Must have been 18 hours, Ryan thought. No wonder he felt stiff.
"You do look much better," Admiral White noted from his leather swivel chair.
He got up, took Ryan's arm, and guided him aft.
"Now for breakfast. I've been waiting for you. Captain Hunter will brief you on our revised orders. Weather's clearing up for a few days, they tell me. Escort assignments are being reshuffled. We're to operate in conjunction with your New Jersey group. Our anti-submarine operations begin in earnest in another 12 hours. It's a good thing you got that extra sleep, lad. You'll bloody need it."
Ryan ran his hand over his face.
"Can I shave, sir?"
"We still permit beards. Let it wait until after breakfast."
Flag quarters on HMS Invincible were not quite to the standard of those on the Kennedy, but close. White had a private dining area. A steward in white livery served them expertly, setting a third place for Hunter, who appeared within a few minutes. When they started talking, the steward was excused.
"We rendezvous with a pair of your Knox-class frigates in 2 hours. We already have them on radar. Two more 1052s plus an oiler and two parries will join us in another 36 hours. They were on their way home from the Med. With our own escorts, a total of 9 warships. A noteworthy collection, I think. We'll be working 500 miles offshore, with the New Jersey Tarawa force 200 miles to our west."
"Tarawa? What do we need a regiment of Marines for?" Ryan asked.
Hunter explained briefly.
"Not a bad idea, that. The funny thing is, with Kennedy racing for the Azores, that rather leaves us guarding the American coast."
Hunter grinned.
"This may be the first time the Royal Navy has ever done that.
Certainly since it belonged to us."
"What are we up against?"
"The first of the Alphas will be on your coast tonight, 4 of them ahead of all the others. The Soviet surface force passed Iceland last night. It's divided into 3 groups. 1 is built around their carrier Kiev, 2 cruisers and 4 destroyers. The second, probably the false flag, is built around Kirov, with 3 additional cruisers and 6 destroyers. And the third is centered on Moskva, 3 more cruisers and 7 destroyers. I gather that the Soviets will want to use the Kiev and Moskva groups inshore, with Kirov guarding them out to sea. But Kennedy's relocation will make them rethink that. Regardless, the total force carries a considerable number of surface-to-surface missiles, and potentially we are very exposed. To help out with that, your Air Force has an E-3 Sentry detailed to arrive here in an hour to exercise with our Harriers, and when we get farther west, we'll have additional land-based air support. On the whole, our position is hardly an enviable one, but Ivan's is rather less so. So far as the question of finding Red October is concerned," Hunter shrugged. "How we conduct our search will depend on how Ivan deploys. At the moment, we're conducting some tracking drills. The lead Alpha is 80 miles northwest of us, steaming at 40-plus knots, and we have a helicopter in pursuit, which is roughly what it amounts to," the fleet operations officer concluded. "Will you join us below?" "Admiral?"
Ryan wanted to see Invincible's combat information center.
"Certainly."
30 minutes later, Ryan was in a darkened, quiet room whose walls were a solid bank of electronic instruments and glass plotting panels. The Atlantic Ocean was full of Russian submarines. The White House. The Soviet ambassador entered the Oval Office a minute early at 10:59 a.m. He was a short, overweight man with a broad Slavic face and eyes that would have done a professional gambler proud. They revealed nothing. He was a career diplomat, having served in a number of posts throughout the Western world,
and a 30-year member of the Communist Party's Foreign Department.
Good morning, Mr. President. Dr. Pelt.
Alexei Arbatov nodded politely to both men. The president, he noted at once, was seated behind his desk. Every other time he'd been here, the president had come around the desk to shake hands, then sat down beside him.
Help yourself to some coffee, Mr. Ambassador, Pelt offered. The special assistant to the president for national security affairs was well known to Arbatov.
Jeffrey Pelt was an academic from the Georgetown University's Center for Strategic and International Studies, an enemy, but a well-mannered, kulturny enemy. Arbatov had a fondness for the niceties of formal behavior. Today, Pelt was standing at his boss's side, unwilling to come too close to the Russian bear. Arbatov did not get himself any coffee.
Mr. Ambassador, Pelt began, we have noted a troubling increase in Soviet naval activity in the North Atlantic.
Oh? Arbatov's eyebrows shot up in a display of surprise that fooled no one, and he knew it.
I have no knowledge of this. As you know, I have never been a sailor.
Shall we dispense with the bullshit, Mr. Ambassador? The president said. Arbatov did not permit himself to be surprised by the vulgarity. It made the American president seem very Russian, and like Soviet officials, he seemed to need a professional like Pelt around to smooth the edges.
You currently have nearly 100 naval vessels operating in the North Atlantic or heading in that direction. Chairman Narmonov and my predecessor agreed years ago that no such operation would take place without prior notification. The purpose of this agreement, as you know, was to prevent acts that might appear to be unduly provocative to one side or the other. This agreement has been kept until now. Now my military advisors tell me that what is going on looks very much like a war exercise, indeed could be the precursor to a war. How are we to tell the difference? Your ships are now passing east of Iceland and will soon be in a position from which they can threaten our trade routes to Europe. The situation is at the least unsettling, and at the most a grave and wholly unwarranted provocation. The scope of this action has not yet been made public. That will change. And when it does, Alex, the American people will demand action on my part. The president paused, expecting a response, but getting only a nod. Pelt went on for him.
Mr. Ambassador, your country has seen fit to cast aside an agreement which for years has been a model of East-West cooperation. How can you expect us to regard this as anything other than a provocation?
Mr. President, Dr. Pelt, truly I have no knowledge of this.
Arbatov lied with utmost sincerity.
I will contact Moscow at once to ascertain the facts. Is there any message you wish me to pass along?
Yes. As you and your superiors in Moscow will understand, the president said, we will deploy our ships and aircraft to observe yours. Prudence requires this. We have no wish to interfere with whatever legitimate operations your forces may be engaged in. It is not our intention to make a provocation of our own. But under the terms of our agreement, we have the right to know what is going on, Mr. Ambassador. Until we do, we are unable to issue the proper orders to our men. It would be well for your government to consider that, having so many of your ships and our ships, your aircraft and our aircraft in close proximity is an inherently dangerous situation. Accidents can happen. An action by one side or the other, which at another time would seem harmless, might seem to be something else entirely. Wars have begun in this way, Mr. Ambassador. The president leaned back to let that thought hang in the air for a moment. When he went on, he spoke more gently. Of course, I regard this possibility as remote, but is it not irresponsible to take such chances?
Mr. President, you make your point well, as always. But as you know, the sea is free for the passage of all and—
Mr. Ambassador, Pelt interrupted, consider a simple analogy. Your next-door neighbor begins to patrol his front yard with a loaded shotgun while your children are at play in your own front yard. In this country, such action would be technically legal. Even so, would it not be a matter of concern?
So it would, Dr. Pelt. But the situation you describe is very different.
Now the president interrupted. Indeed it is.
the situation at hand is far more dangerous. It is the breach of an agreement, and I find that especially disquieting. I had hoped that we were entering a new era of Soviet-American relations. We have settled our trade differences. We have just